From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as President Trump threatens new tariffs on Mexico, the auto industry could be caught in the crossfire.
You add a big increase to prices and you get a big decrease for sales. So what does that translate into? Lots of lost American jobs.
We meet the new head of the Arab American National Museum.
Museums are, one of the most trusted institutions around. And I think what they do best is really show that the human experience is a shared one.
Making theater come alive for people who are visually impaired.
The thing that I love about audio description is it's a creative process, just like theater.
What can fans expect from Michigan's new basketball coach?
Don't count on any banners going up next year. If he does that, then coach of the year.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll talk with the new director of Dearborn's Arab American National Museum.
It's been basically my life's work to study and to share and educate and teach others about the richness of the Middle East, its history, its culture.
That comes up later on Stateside, but first, Mexican officials are in Washington today meeting with their U.S. counterparts, searching for a way to tamp down President Trump's threat to impose new tariffs on goods made in Mexico. It all stems from a dispute over illegal immigration, and the auto industry looks to be caught in the crossfire. Paul Eisenstein is publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. His recent piece for NBCNews.com breaks down the dollars and cents of what these threatened tariffs could mean for car buyers. So, Paul, the president's threatening to start with a 5% tariff on Mexican-made goods and then ratchet that up to a full 25% by October unless Mexico does something effective to stem the flow of migrants into the U.S. What would that full 25% do to the sticker price of cars?
Well, I'll tell you what, let's start on the low end, and then let's work our way
all
up,
right,
if you don't mind.
Let's do that.
Okay, so let's take the typical car. Car sales are starting to roll out right about now, and will continue through tomorrow. And we'll hear that the typical vehicle that Americans purchase, what they call transaction price, is what you actually pay. It's about $34,000, $35,000. Okay, if that vehicle, when you are talking about out of the factory, were to be tariffed, that the actual cost to the manufacturer is probably about $25,000. So the 5% means an immediate hit of about $1,250.
No.
Not exactly a small hit.
No.
I mean, you're talking about some expensive vehicles like, say, an Audi Q5 that is only built, the only place in the world they build it is in Mexico. That's about $2,000. Now, let's do a simple math. You take that up to October when the tariffs are supposed to increase to 25%. Multiply those numbers by five. An average vehicle will go up about $6,000 or so, and an Audi Q5 might cost you anywhere up to another $12,000 or $15,000. There are some vehicles, a lot of pickups are made down there. The Ram 1500, the Chevy Silverado, for example, and some of those can get up to $60,000 or $70,000. If you've got a $60,000 pickup, by October, you're going to be paying another $15,000 for it. Can I make things even worse for the consumer?
Go for it.
Well, here's the problem. You may say, well, I'm not going to buy a Mexican car. No, yeah, you probably will, because these days the borders are pretty porous. That's why we had NAFTA. And so a lot of the components that go into the typical U.S. assembled car still come from Mexico. Almost all of the wiring harnesses, trim pieces, and even engines in some cases come from south of the border. So those are going to be tariffed. So, for example, you may have a vehicle that is assembled, say, in Kentucky or Dearborn or somewhere else, but they may still go up $1,000 or more because of the Mexican parts that are in those vehicles.
And, of course, the president likes to say to companies, you don't like these tariffs? Build in the United States.
Yeah, right. Let's get real about this. First of all, trying to turn things around in short order is not easy. You can't just put up a factory overnight. The reality is you've had almost three decades now of building a continental network. And the cost of tearing it up and putting in factories that would run below capacity in the United States, well, guess what? that's going to add thousands of dollars to the cost of those vehicles anyway, and it would still take a few years before they could do it if they really, really, really wanted to.
Paul, what about the timing of all of this for the auto industry in terms of new car prices and also new car sales? What are analysts telling you?
They're telling us very simply, it could be a rout. It's going to be a rout, is the way one analyst, Joe Filippi, put it. He's a veteran. He's been covering this business even longer than I have, and I've been on the beat for 40 years. No, it's going to be a very, very serious problem if it goes through. As you probably know, new car sales are off about 3% this year, and May does not look to be any better. We don't have the final numbers, but all the preliminary data suggests sales are going down. You add a big increase to prices, and you get a big decrease for sales. So what does that translate into? Lots of lost American jobs.
And that's what I had to wonder, all this uncertainty. What does it mean for automakers and for the many people in Michigan relying on the auto companies and the suppliers for their paychecks?
It could mean that a lot of people wind up losing jobs. You have a lot of factories right now that are running below capacity. People have been sort of losing the fact that we've seen a lot of job cuts in the auto industry despite the supposedly great economy. In some ways it is, but the reality is that the U.S. auto market is essentially the canary in the coal mine. And when you see the economy start to weaken, you're probably going to spot it first in the auto industry. Guess what? We are spotting it in the auto industry. We saw, of course, General Motors announce big cuts. We are seeing big cuts at Ford. Even some of the imports are under strain and trying to figure out what to do about their factories and about their jobs. There's only a couple automakers that are really doing well right now. One of them is Fiat Chrysler. But they could be hit, too, because, again, they're producing a lot of products down in Mexico. And by the way, to give you a sense of this, General Motors is producing something like 500,000 vehicles a year down in Mexico, including some of their most profitable products.
Paul Eisenstein, publisher of thedetroitbureau.com. Always great to get your insights, Paul. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
It is time now to check in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon, and this is our chance to dig into the big hire. Juwan Howard held his first press conference late last week as Michigan basketball's brand new head coach. Were you surprised by this hire?
A little, but almost anybody would have surprised me because there was no clear candidate this time. There's no Harbaugh out there that everyone says, that's the guy, can you get him? Not in this case. So it surprised me a little bit, but probably in some ways, in hindsight, perhaps, probably the least surprising of the possible picks.
Interesting. Well, certainly people know Howard is one of the Fab Five at Michigan, and worth noting he was not implicated in that basketball scandal with Michigan involving Ed Martin.
And I can add to that, I've talked to Greg Stayskill of the FBI, FBI special agent. He's the one who started the steroid investigation that ended up snaring Michigan State's chemist, as well as Major League Baseball. That's where it all started with Greg Stayskill here in Ann Arbor. But he investigated Ed Martin. He's the one who figured out Chris Webber took more than $200,000, and also that Juwan Howard's fingerprints were nowhere near it.
So we know that. And we know he spent the last 26 years in the NBA, winding up as assistant coach for 6 years with Miami, but never a head coach.
True. I will say this. 20 years in the NBA as a player is extraordinary. There are many, many Hall of Famers who did not put in 20 years. It's an unusual streak, which shows you how highly regarded he was, mainly on defense, it must be noted. 6 years as an assistant coach, which does impress me because this guy's got over $100 million. And I don't know what being an assistant coach in the NBA costs, but it's not $100 million. So you're carrying a clipboard, you're on the bench, you're traveling like crazy. It is a hard, thankless job. And he spent 6 years as a bench jockey doing that. You are dedicated to learning this craft. So I'll give him that. Flip side is, as you point out, there's assistant coach and there's head coach. And Bo Schembechler told me a very smart thing. When I became the head coach of the Ann Arbor Huron High School hockey team, which is not quite the same as Michigan basketball, we will concede. He said, man, when you're an assistant coach, you make suggestions. And when you're a head coach, you make decisions. Ooh. And these are not the same things. And he saw a lot of great assistant coaches not become great head coaches. So you really never know. But the fact is, no matter who Ward Manuel picked, Ward Manuel picked, the Michigan AD, you're going to take a chance in one way or the other. There's no perfect candidate out there.
All right. And he certainly inherited from John Beilein, Michigan basketball is a finely tuned, well-oiled machine. But without three of their big starters from last season. And top recruit Jalen Wilson decommitted from Michigan once Beilein announced he was heading to Cleveland in the NBA. So what does all this mean for the new coach?
In the short term, you're screwed.
Okay.
That's what it means. Don't count on any banners going up next year. If he does that, then coach of the year. But yeah, you're missing basically most of your team. Jalen Wilson, named after Jalen Rose, the old Fab Five teammate, by the way, has decommitted. However, now that Howard is the head coach, he's still got a chance of getting him in Ann Arbor. He's a big-time commit. So that'd be big. Getting Franz Wagner, Mo Wagner's brother out of Germany, would also be a big commit. Getting Saadi Washington, the current assistant coach under Beilein, getting him to stay would help a lot. So all is not lost, but don't think of this as a one-year thing. Then you're blind to the future. So this has got to be a 5-10-year plan.
What do fans want most?
They want an NCAA title tomorrow.
And beat Michigan State.
Of course, five times out of three.
I want to pivot over to the Lions for a minute. Kelvin Johnson put it out there to his former team. You want to fix what is wrong between us. Here, I'm quoting him. Put that money back in my pocket. In other words, give me back the million of the signing bonus that the Lions made Johnson give back when he walked away after the 2015 season. What is going on here?
I can't quite be sure, to be honest, because I don't know the particulars of that contract. Now, usually a signing bonus is a one-time deal, just what it says. A bonus for signing this contract, here's $1 million. And once that's paid, you don't get anything back, whether if he blows out his knee or walks away or whatever. If, however, it was contingent upon him completing the contract, then it's a different thing, in which case it's not really a signing bonus.
Yeah.
So my guess is Johnson is right and the Lions are wrong, but I don't know yet. But I do know this is the second gigantic star with Barry Sanders to walk away with plenty of years left he could have played because they find the Lions organization so incompetent. And that speaks for itself. This has been a 30-year run at least.
But should a team give $1 million back to someone who retired without notice? I know it was a $16 million signing bonus and they made him give $1 million back. But
it depends what the contract says.
Yeah.
This is for lawyers, not for me.
And so we'll have to watch and keep an eye on that soap opera, if you will.
By the way, keep in mind, it's not too easy to be sympathetic with a guy who got 15 out of $16 million of your signing bonus and still quit. So there are no heroes here, and I'm not sure there are really any victims.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Ubake. And thanks, John.
Thank you.
Coming up, making theater come alive for people who are visually impaired.
We attended a live theater performance last year with two other friends who were visually impaired, and it was a game of telephone throughout that performance. So all of us left thinking, huh, there's got to be a way to do this better.
That is after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Kalamazoo Civic Theater has a slogan, Theater for All, and they really mean it. Performances in American Sign Language for people who have hearing impairments, sensory-friendly performances for kids who are on the autism spectrum, and now audio descriptions of what's happening on stage for people who are visually impaired. Abby Tung is the one who's doing these audio descriptions for the Kalamazoo Civic Theater. Abby's a grad student at Western Michigan's Department of Blindness and Low Vision Studies. Abby Tung, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So good to have you here. And we want to welcome Usman Karoma, who's offering expert assistance to Abby in this theater effort. Usman has been blind since he was a teenager, and he is Abby's fiancé. Usman, hello and welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, Abby, what a great idea. I mean, people who are sight impaired want to enjoy the theater. So start with telling us how you do this. I mean, actors are on stage doing their performance. Where are you and what are you doing?
So as the audio descriptionist for the Kalamazoo Civic Theater, I have a very special little studio in the basement right under the stage, which means during the dance numbers, I get to hear them right above my head. I have a microphone in front of me and my script with all of my notes on it, as well as a TV screen. So as the performance is going on, I am watching it on my television screen, following along in my script, and speaking my parts into the microphone as necessary.
And I will second what you say about the bumping and the thumping, because I got to sit in with the musicians for The Lion King some years back. It was a wonderful experience, but I remember all of that bumping and banging going on over your head with no way to see what's happening on the stage. So you've got a video feed. You can see what's happening. And how do you prepare what you say? There aren't scripts for audio descriptionists, are there, like there are for actors?
No, there are not. So I receive, at the beginning of rehearsal period, I receive a script that is unmarked. And I get to go through, and by watching the tech rehearsal, the dress rehearsal, I write in my descriptions. And those are written in the margins, oftentimes erased and rewritten until they fit the timing of the performance. And those are what I get to read on the show night.
And how do the audience members who want this feed, how do they pick it up? How do they hear what you're saying?
The theater has purchased several audio description devices that have one earbud, and those are worn by audience members who want to enjoy the audio description. So you can request those when you purchase your ticket, and they allow for the listener to hear the performance through one ear and hear the description through their other.
Well, Abby, let's hear you in action right now.
Our first scene takes place at the English Grand Prix racetrack. On the balcony, English racegoers wave British flags and flags which read 1910 British Grand Prix. On the stage below, the two children sit behind the wheel of the old rusty ramshackle race car, pretending to drive in a race. The children sit at the breakfast table while Mr. Potts holds up a fresh egg. He puts it in his breakfast-making machine.
You know, it's such a great idea, because it occurs to me, if I was with a friend who was visually impaired, I would be whispering and annoying people around me. Is that how you came to do this?
Well, actually, it was the starting point for us. We attended a live theater performance last year with two other friends who were visually impaired. And yes, it was a game of telephone throughout that performance, which was displeasing to the people around us, obviously, and was not ideal for us. So all of us left that performance thinking, huh, there's got to be a way to do this better. But we didn't really have the solution until the Civic Theater reached out to us and asked us to help pioneer this program.
Interesting. And are there audio descriptionists elsewhere? Because I'll admit, I've not heard of this before. Are you breaking some new ground here?
You know, it's really fun. Getting involved in this project has opened my eyes to the audio description community. And there are several around the country and even in the state of Michigan. It's done in different ways. And there are even a few trainings on it. So that's really the next step with the Kalamazoo Civic Theater, is to go to some national trainings. But we certainly are the first in Kalamazoo and in the area. So that's been exciting.
So give me an idea, if you will, like what kinds of things are you saying as a play is going on? What would I be hearing if I had that little earbud in?
I start the performance with about a 5-minute introduction that summarizes things that the audience members will be seeing throughout the show. And those include things like the scenery, the costumes, the visuals that I don't have time to describe as the performance is running. So I'll give an overview before the show even starts. Then as the show begins, a lot of what I describe is honestly the entrances and the exits. So it's not too glamorous, but then there are the moments where something very crucial happens. Someone pulls out something from behind their back, or someone hands something to someone else, or someone blushes at a remark. Those kind of things I get to describe between lines or between song stanzas, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're doing the scene setting and then getting out of the way to let the dialogue continue the story.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Usman, as someone who is blind, tell me, how have you been able to help Abby with this work? What kind of directions have you been able to give her, things that she might not have been aware of that you are?
Mostly, like she said, like we both like attend tech rehearsals, and then after she writes in the script, like she will go over it again, and I will like help her to like cut or leave things in there. Like sometimes her descriptions are either too much or two later. So we just go from there, like we just bounce ideas. Because like as a descriptionist, you don't want to like tell the whole story within your description. So just hover to kind of like make it short and right to the point instead of telling a story within a story.
Yeah, so like helping the story but getting out of the way and letting the actors really do the storytelling. So she's kind
exactly.
of the, she's painting the background.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little about your story. Why and how did your vision change?
That's a long story. I was born in Liberia in the 90s, and pretty much during the Civil War, like, we mm-hmm. left, and I was born with cataracts, and living in different countries and different refugee camps, like, with no medical care, my eyesight kept decreasing, and I went completely blind when I was 14. And when I moved to the States, the doctor said that the cataracts turned into glaucoma because of no medical care. So,
How much did that whole process in the end game that you lost your sight, you were 14 years old, how much did that change your life or what you felt you wanted to do?
It did a lot, honestly, because I mean, when I could see, like, I rely on my eyes and did everything with my eyes, and I thought I was, like, invincible, which I still think that way. but, like, when I went blind, it really changed my life. I transformed things, like, where I'll appreciate things more now, I would say, than when I used to see. Like, I appreciate food more because I don't see it. I smell it, I taste it, I feel it. Even, like, in a relationship, like, I used to look at a female, like, how they look. And now I kind of, by seeing female, like, by seeing Abby, I can tell how beautiful she is because of her voice, of her attitude, of, like, what is in her heart, not what is outside.
And so, how did you two meet?
We met in 2012 at a nonprofit organization that I used to work at. She came to volunteer, and then we just became close friends. And then after that, we hired her. She worked there for 2 years, and our friendship just grew, and here we are.
And here you are. If you've just joined us, we're talking with Usman Koroma and with Abby Tung about this very interesting effort that Abby's doing with Kalamazoo Civic Theater. She is a descriptionist. She provides audio descriptions of what's happening on stage for people who are visually impaired. Abby, I know you're working on your master's at Western, and you're there with the Department of Blindness and Low Vision Studies. What drew you to this field?
Wow. In high school, I watched the movie The Miracle Worker and was just captivated by the concept of working with kids who are blind. It is about Anne Sullivan and Helen Keller. And without knowing anyone who is blind, I was very inspired and looked into the job and found it was for me.
What do you think that was that spoke to you? Why did it strike such a chord, do you think?
I just love the concept of building bridges in whatever capacity I can. Anne Sullivan builds a lot of bridges between Helen, who doesn't have any way to express herself or understand the world around her. Anne Sullivan builds a bridge between Helen and the world around her. And I find myself doing that so often. And now I can do it as my career, as I build bridges between my students and the worlds around them.
So you're teaching. Tell us about the work you're doing on your master's and what your career goal is.
So I'm getting my double master's in teaching students with vision impairments and orientation and mobility for children, which boils down to traveling if you're visually impaired. And I actually just came from a day with my students teaching Braille, teaching technology skills, teaching cane travel. So I get to do that in the schools. I drive from school to school, and I'm currently accumulating my internship hours, and it is so much fun. It is absolutely worth every lecture I sat through.
So as I think of this background and this study and the academic work you're doing, certainly that sets you up in a very, very fine way to be an audio descriptor for the theater. What would it take if someone's listening to what you're talking about and thinking, I think I would like to do that? Like, what kind of skills do you need, and could you do it without as much training as you've had, through the Department of Blindness and Low Vision Studies?
Absolutely. We are actually launching our first training session for other community members who want to do audio description here in Kalamazoo. And the people who went through the training started by saying, I don't know if I can do this, and ended saying, gosh, I really think I've got the hang of it, or at least I know where I can improve myself. So in order to describe, all you need to do is see and describe what you see. It's really that simple, and everyone has their different style. The thing that I love about audio description is it's a creative process, just like theater. And as long as you can really dive into it, make it your own, you'll have an awesome time doing it.
Yeah, I want to say, in addition to that, like what we told them during the training is that, like, when you're writing like an audio description, like you should write it like it's like for yourself. Like, what do you want to see if you are blind or blindfolded? Like, what would you like to be described to you? So it's like personal to you. That makes it, I guess, easier for your audience to visualize.
Absolutely. And when I think of the audio narration style, because we certainly have many styles of narrating copy, I've been doing this for almost 40 years, and there's different ways you approach different copy. And it made me wonder, Abby, when you're doing this, do you try to do a little acting to reflect the emotion of what's going on stage, or do you just go for a straightforward narration?
Honestly, I don't have a lot of time. Most of my comments are within the 1 to 3 second range. Mm. So although I would love to do some acting of my own, I usually leave that to the performers.
There you go. So you're just little comments here and there. So how many shows have you done so far?
So I have done 3 performances, started out with Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and moved on to Madagascar Junior and just finished War Paint.
Okay, so all a little bit different, but musicals.
Different.
But musicals.
Yes.
Yes. So tell me what you hear from audiences, especially that first time when people came in and, oh, look what's available. And the word had, you know, was maybe not out.
Yeah, the feedback that we've gotten from the people who have enjoyed the service has been overwhelmingly positive. A lot of comments on how it's helped them understand the performance, how it's helped them enjoy theater more, as well as general comments just thanking the Civic for thinking of them. It really is very meaningful to know that the Civic is going out of their way to include all members of the community. And maybe, Usman, you could speak to that as one of those first people, what your initial thoughts were.
Yeah, like honestly, like when Abby told me the first time, like I was like, what? Like, what are they thinking? And then, I mean, like I always, and I know some friends who are blind who always like wants to go to the theater to enjoy things like with their sighted friends. And however, like this opportunity was not there for them. And now it is. So it's making like the weekend planning more enjoyable, like, because you have a lot of options. You can go and do things that you love doing, which like watching theater, watching, supporting the local community, local actors and actresses. So it's been a blessing, and it's really, really excited for the new season coming up in September. So
when we think of so many theater companies around Michigan, community theater companies like the Civic, professional theater companies, what would it take to get more audio descriptionists into more theaters to open up the theater experience to more people?
Honestly, it just takes a vision, which, no pun intended, that was bad, my apologies. But the Civic didn't know anything about audio description before starting, and they just learned as they went. We just learned as we went. And if you build it, they will come. The Civic reached out, purchased the equipment, reached out to Western, found someone who was willing to pioneer their describing, which was me. And here they are getting ready to create a sustainable community performance opportunity for all members of the community.
Yeah. So should someone want to find out more, say we're going to have people listening all around the state, would they reach out to you through Western?
They can absolutely do that. I found a ton of my resources on the website for the American Council for the Blind. They have lots and lots of videos, articles, everything about audio description, and that's where I got my start. But they are welcome to reach out to me, and we can collaborate and compare notes and learn together.
What a wonderful effort that the two of you are doing together. What's it like working with each other?
It's joyful. Like, we are, I mean, growing through it, so which is good for our relationship. Yeah, we love, as Abby said, like building a community, like mm-hmm. connecting like the blind planner and the sighted planner together, because we are all one people. So we love doing things like that.
Well, it is a wonderful effort, and we want to congratulate you on this. Abby Tung, who is a grad student at Western Michigan University's Department of Blindness and Low Vision Studies, and she is an audio descriptor, providing audio descriptions for productions at the Kalamazoo Civic Theater for people who are visually impaired. And we've been talking to her fiancé, Usman Karoma, who brings that perspective of someone who has been blind since he was 14 and who loves the theater. Thank you so much to both of you. It was really great to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, we'll talk with Michigan native and HGTV co-founder Susan Packard about how to build healthier relationships at work.
The truth is, as you move up in the ranks in organizations, you become less and less emotionally fit. And CEOs have the least amount of emotional fitness and in many cases are barely human.
That comes after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Arab American National Museum in Dearborn is the first and only museum in this country devoted to Arab American history and culture, and it recently named a new director. Dr. Diana Abouali was born in Toronto to Palestinian parents. She earned her PhD in history and Middle Eastern studies from Harvard. She taught at Dartmouth and then worked in the museum and heritage sectors in Palestine and in Jordan. I sat down with Abouali during our Dearborn show back in May, and I started by asking her, what was it about this museum that made her decide to accept the job of its director?
The opportunity to work at a museum like this that has such national prominence, the ability to share the stories of Arab Americans. Like you said, my background is as an academic. I study Middle Eastern history, and it's been basically my life's work to study and to share and educate and teach others about the richness of the Middle East, its history, its culture. And so this was, I think, an opportunity for me to come and to continue to share that knowledge that I have, but also to learn more and to think of, you know, ways in which I can share that knowledge and learn more about the Arab American, you know, experience and culture as well. So it's really an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Now, I'm interested, you have been certainly in the Middle East and Ivy League colleges. Had you been to Dearborn in depth before you accepted this job or began interviewing for this job?
I came to Dearborn once in the 1990s.
Okay.
So my family, as you said, I was born in Toronto, Canada, but I left when I was 7. We moved to Kuwait, which is where actually my parents met. They were working there, got married, and immigrated from. So during the Gulf War in 1990, we were there, and during the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. So we were all actually evacuated from Kuwait. And my parents relocated to London, Ontario, which is where I still have uncles who live there. They're my father's brothers that he had sponsored in the 70s to come over. So I remember once on one of my visits there, I was in college, and we came to Dearborn and ate kenafa at one of the spots. So that's all I remember. But I remember being fascinated by the signs in Arabic, the stores, the Arabic community. And I have to say, it wasn't the first time I was sort of introduced or exposed to the Arab community in America. Actually, the first time was in a classroom in Kuwait, when we learned about and studied what we call the poets in exile, of whom is Khalil Gibran Ali Abu Mahdi. So just to tell you about the sort of the reach of Arab Americans, but that little trip in the early 90s was my first exposure here.
What role do cultural institutions like museums play in creating understanding across different cultures, especially at a time when we at a nation aren't doing so well with that?
Look, museums are, you know, one of the most trusted institutions around. They have an educational role. And I think what they do best is really show that the human experience is a shared one and that we are, you know, really one family. And I think in this sort of climate of, you know, Islamophobia, xenophobia, museums like the Arab American National Museum and other museums that tell the story of immigration to America are really important. I think we have an educational mission, not just to inform people about Arab Americans and other immigrant communities and how the Arab American story is the story of America, but we also are sort of counteracting these misconceptions and showing that, you know, there's an alternative and we have a story to tell, the story that's based on, you know, the voices, the experiences of Arab Americans.
You're just a month into the job, but I have no doubt you have thought deeply about this position, this museum, and what you can do as its director. So how do you see yourself taking this museum in new directions, but also keeping what's been working over the past 13 years?
So this is a museum, from my understanding of it, from my learning about it, from knowing about it. It's really a place where we strive for excellence in all that we do. And I think, you know, the fact that we're a Smithsonian affiliate, that we're accredited by the American Alliance of Museums, our programming has won awards. So I'm really proud of this museum and I hope to continue on that path. What I'd like to do is sort of broaden our outreach more and make the museum more accessible. By that I mean, for instance, bringing in communities that may not feel that their stories are reflected in the stories that we tell at the Arab American Museum. So in the 15 years since we've been open, you know, the face of Arab America has changed. Immigration, you know, is a constant thing, and so the demographics have changed. And we want to represent the communities that may have not been as prominent in 2005 when we opened. We also want to make it accessible place to anybody who wants to come to museum, accessible to people who maybe, for whatever reason, may not have been able to visit museums. So we want to make sure that we are as inclusive as we can be.
And how do you do that?
One of the ways we can do it is to really bolster our digital presence. That's a priority for me. You know, I really want to take, for instance, our website and make it, maybe not cutting edge, but really able to be a platform where we can share the exhibitions we do, the programming we do, because that's really the way in which to reach audiences beyond Dearborn and the Metro Detroit. We are definitely a community-based organization, and we serve our community here, the Arab American and the non-Arab American. Everyone is welcome here. But we have an Arab American national community that I really would like to reach out and include them more in what we do and really make this institution an anchor for Arab Americans. It's a place where we document and preserve and talk about Arab American contributions, and we're a place that produces knowledge about Arab Americans. We have an amazing archive here, and it's a place where researchers can come and anyone can come and learn about Arab American history.
Well, thank you again for your hospitality.
Thank you so
and
much.
The best of luck as you kind of take your arms and wrap it around this new position that you have as the director of the Arab American National Museum. Dr. Diana Abouili, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside. It's been said that emotional intelligence is the key to both personal and professional success. Well, how to better manage your emotions and those around you? That's the subject of a new book by Susan Packard, the co-founder of HGTV, and she was on the startup teams for HBO and CNBC. She grew up in Detroit, and she graduated from Michigan State. Her new book is titled Fully Human, Three Steps to Grow Your Emotional Fitness in Work, Leadership, and Life. Susan, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm just delighted to be here, Denise.
So are many of us not fully human?
Well, I would say that it is a lifelong process, and my sector has been the business workplace, and this book talks about emotional intelligence, which is a workplace skill, and how where we're succeeding with it and when we're failing. And the truth is, as you move up in the ranks in organizations, you become less and less emotionally fit, which are my words, and CEOs have the least amount of emotional fitness and in many cases are barely human, to answer your question.
That is it's a fascinating phrase, but I dare say there are a lot of folks out there saying amen. So
yeah.
you think about the person who appears to be successful, you know, have grabbed the golden ring, but could
right.
be very well coping with fear and feeling disconnected. And when that person's a leader and someone in management, tell us how you've seen that affect the team and affect the company. What have you seen in your career?
Well, somebody is leading with fear, meaning not necessarily dogmatically leading, but has a lot of fear that they carry with them. Often what ends up happening is when you ask, when you brainstorm with them, when you're talking about resources, the answer is always no, because no is the safe place for leaders who are fear-based. And it's not the healthy place for a company. It's not emotionally healthy and it's not economically healthy to always be flashing lines through a P&L when you can do little things that make all the difference in getting your people behind you.
And that's where that idea of EQ fitness comes in, which is what? What is EQ fitness and what are the principles of it?
Yeah, so what I've done is I've taken this idea of emotional intelligence and I've brought a current to the workplace of 2019. And what I mean by that is that I needed to gain some self-awareness myself. I realized that when I was 39 years old and managing hundreds of people at HGTV, that I did a good job on reading people and responding effectively to them. But the part about the self-awareness, which is the second part of emotional intelligence, I had done such a lifetime of stuffing down unsettled emotions that I kind of lost touch with myself. And if you're a leader, you have to lead from a place of inner solid grounding. So what I did with emotional fitness is it's basically three steps. The first is diving a little deeper into self-awareness and getting to a place of inner alignment, if you will, you know, are my values aligned with my outer work and my larger life? And then the second step is building relationships of trust. And the third step is leading with we principles, W-E, meaning you have a perspective that's not just me focused, but you actually move yourself aside for the greater good of the organization.
And that helps that leader, that manager to be able to do, as you put it, there are many, many things that maybe doesn't cost a penny, but it makes people just feel included and feel valued.
Yeah. In fact, there's a story about Best Buy and Hubert Joly took over in 2012 when it was on life support. And it was going to go into bankruptcy. And one of the things he did right away was he resurrected the employee discount. So here were these demoralized employees who'd gone through multiple leaders over the course of 5 years. He came in and he said, whoa, let's resurrect this. And he had those employees for life. It was a small thing and it was barely noticeable on the P&L. But that's the kind of leadership a leader who's emotionally fit to do.
One of the things that really jumped out at me in your book, Fully Human, was the CEO who did have that kind of emotional and EQ fitness where he could say to his team, what can I do to help you?
Oh, yeah. That was Yarrow Moon, who runs NPR National Public Radio.
Yeah. A name we know here. And what a valuable thing to say to your team. What can I do to help you? And it struck me that most people didn't want to have him do work for them, right? It was just having that acknowledged.
Right. Absolutely. And for the most part, they said, no, thanks. But they reacted. He said he could see how they physically changed posture when he would ask that question. And it was kind of like, you know, knowing that you have people in the boat with you, and especially your leader.
We hear so much talk about leadership and leadership skills. But in your book, Susan Packard, you write about followership. And I'd never thought of that before, but boy, the followers are the ones who make things happen, aren't they?
Yep. And there's a lot of research around this. So I spent a day at Carnegie Mellon, and one of the professors there has written books on followership. And, you know, the problem in our culture is nobody wants to be called a follower, even though if they're really comfortable being a follower. You know, so a lot of this is nomenclature, but he found that when you looked at a structure of a team, the person that was at the very top was responsible for something like 15 or 20% of the overall result of whatever the initiative was. 80% was the team, the quote-unquote followers. So how critical they are. I mean, you can do it without a leader, but you can't do it without the follower.
Yeah. And again, a workplace that has EQ fitness that will make people feel valued. But I'm wondering, can a single person make a change in the overall workplace, even if, let's say, the boss or others in management are not working on their EQ fitness?
That is the most common question I get as I've been on this book tour, which suggests to me that there are a lot of unhealthy cultures out there. I'm not surprised by that. My research supports it. In fact, one of the pieces of data is one out of five CEOs exhibit some form of psychopathic behavior at work. So, you know, when you're looking at culture, we really have to look at all of this. But culture is too big for any one person. But what you can do is you can bring it to your immediate team, department, and you can look at, you know, how about the folks around me that I work with every day? And how about my boss? And it's possible that that little ecosystem could be very emotionally healthy and strong. The larger culture, on the other hand, might not be. But if there's a way for you to almost cocoon yourself with the people that you work with day in and day out, then it's possible to find some peace of mind, you know, in a workplace.
I don't want to let you go without touching about the fact that you write a lot about mindfulness and the benefits of meditation and also spirituality, not necessarily religion, but spiritual thinking. What role does all of that have in the workplace? And what happens when it's missing from our jobs, from our lives?
Yes. So this was the hardest part for me to write because step three, we principles, is about the appropriate times to move ourselves aside for the greater good. And as leaders, I mean, all great leaders, all noble leaders have evolved this way. And part of that is having a, what I call spiritual insight, which is essentially a perspective of humility to recognize I'm not why this place is successful. I contribute to it. I have an important role to play, but you know, it's all of the people around me and recognizing them and showing instances of gratitude. One of the stories I tell is my boss, Ken Lowe at HGTV, you know, he would say to me, Suze, don't forget to thank them whenever I spoke in front of a group. And I was good one-on-one with my folks, but when the large groups, I would just forget. And so he would remind me, and eventually it became second nature, like an inner muscle. And those kinds of things are really spiritual practices that get us outside of our own sort of egos to meld with the rest of the organization and keep it healthy and strong.
What do you hope readers get from your book, Fully Human?
Well, I always say is that if they can get a nugget or two of information that can inspire them to do something new, something different, that would be healthy, emotionally healthy for them. For example, with trust, you know, trust is the second step. If in a trust relationship, drop your cell phone, put it in your pocket when you're talking to somebody, put it on the table, put it away and look somebody in the eye. There's so many simple things, little things you can do that don't take much effort at all that can help you with each of these three steps.
Both at work and at home.
Exactly.
Susan Packard, who is the co-founder of Scripps Networks Interactive and also the former chief operating officer at HGTV. And she was also part of the team that helped to start up HBO and CNBC. And she is a Detroiter. The book, again, Fully Human, Three Steps to Grow Your Emotional Fitness in Work, Leadership, and Life. Susan, it was a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you so very, very much.
And thank you for having me on your show.
tomorrow, we'll take you to the Bluebird Inn Jazz Club in Detroit, once a top destination for musical greats like Charlie Parker, Miles Davis. The legendary club on the city's west side has long been abandoned.
You know, the building's just gone through a lot. There's a lot of waterlogged stuff. It rained last night. You can see the light coming through the roof. You know, the ceiling, the tin ceiling has sort of fallen in.
We'll check in on the effort to restore Detroit's Bluebird Inn. That's tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.